Today on the 21st Show, Federal Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has called autism an epidemic that destroys families. He's also attributed a rise in diagnoses to debunked ideas about vaccines.
These are kids who will never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, they'll never play baseball, they'll never write a poem, they'll never go out on a date.
But not everyone sees autism, at least not all forms of autism, the way Kennedy does. We'll talk about the effect his actions and rhetoric are having here in Illinois. I'm Brian Mackey. That's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In just over 3 months as the Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has continued to voice opinions that are both controversial and often at odds with scientific and medical research. One major point of criticism is his skepticism about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines. Here he is in 2023 with the libertarian news outlet Reason.
There's not one of the 72 vaccine doses now mandated for American children that have ever been through a placebo-controlled study relicensure. That's outrageous. Every other medicine has to go through pre-licensing safety studies. The vaccines are the only ones that are exempt, and we're mandating them for healthy children. And all I'm saying is, let's do a real safety study so that we know the risk profile on these products, we know what the benefits are, and then give people the real, you know, that real information.
The word relicensure is key there, actually. To be clear, the original version of childhood vaccinations, such as polio, the mumps, hepatitis A and B, they were all tested against placebos. But newer versions of those medicines, often making small adjustments here and there, are tested differently. And in fact, there are those who say it could be unethical to withhold well-established life-saving vaccines for new placebo trials. Meanwhile, Kennedy has also repeated the false claim that vaccines cause autism. And then, last month, at a news conference, he said this.
Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. These are kids who, many of them, were fully functional and regressed because of some environmental exposure into autism when they're 2 years old.
He also called autism an epidemic. Some parents are applauding RFK Jr.'s approach to autism, but others on and off the autism spectrum call that harmful rhetoric. Today for the hour, we are going to talk about autism, what we know about it, how Kennedy is talking about it, and how that's being felt here in Illinois. With me to talk about this is Molly Losh. She's professor of learning disabilities and associate dean for research at Northwestern University's School of Communication. Her PhD is in developmental psychology. Dr. Losh, or Molly, if I may, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're also joined today by Taylor Sweeting. He's an autism self-advocate and disability self-advocate. He's based in Springfield, Illinois. Taylor, welcome back to the 21st Show to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zoe Gross is Director of Advocacy for the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, a nonprofit organization based out of Washington, D.C. It's run by and for people on the autism spectrum. The organization advocates for the inclusion of autistic people in all aspects of life. Zoe, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And finally, Hannah Epker is with us. She's based in Lake County, and she is the parent of an autistic child. Hannah, thank you for being here as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join the conversation throughout the hour today by calling 800-222-9455. What do you think of Kennedy's remarks on autism, how he's approaching it? How does autism affect people in your life? And what do you think of Kennedy's pledge to find the cause of autism? 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join us. 800-222-9455. All right, Molly Losh, I'm going to start with you with a bit of context. We hear this phrase a lot now, the autism spectrum. Autism is a spectrum. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it means we see a lot of variability. So the criteria used to diagnose autism involves impairment in two main areas: social communication, so how we're engaging with others, how we use language to connect through conversation, social emotional connections, developing relationships and friendships. And then the other main criterion is restricted and repetitive behaviors. So this encompasses a really wide range of behaviors, from repetitive motor behaviors like hand flapping or rocking to more cognitively based features such as rigid or repetitive thoughts and intense, all-encompassing interests in a particular topic. And then a newer recognition in our current diagnostic criteria that involves sensory disturbances, which has been so important and unrecognized previously, which recognizes the heightened or reduced sensitivity to different sensory features that many autistic individuals experience. So brighter flickering lights, loud noises, scratchy fabric, and autism is a spectrum. So within each of these different areas, we see a really broad range of expression where some individuals may have limited or no functional language ability, more severe repetitive behaviors, and very high support needs. Others who have more limited challenges to just restricted to using language in social contexts like conversation and social interactions, and show more cognitively based differences in repetitive thoughts and behaviors. I can go on, but I'll pause here.
Yeah, no. So I think we have a good sense for the breadth of what we're talking about. This is autism is not any one thing. So maybe that's a good segue to ask Taylor Sweeting, what does autism look like for you?
So for me, autism is an identity. It's a part of who I am. I am very much the kind of person, I believe in people first culture, people first language. So obviously I'm a person first, and that's the most important aspect of my identity. But autism is in every aspect of my life. I can't separate myself from my autism. So it really encompasses so many different aspects of not just who I am as a person, but of my special interests, how I conduct, myself daily, and really also kind of embracing the challenges and the aspects of how autism affects my everyday life, I think is extremely important, and why I feel like, my identity is so ingrained within my autism diagnosis.
If you're comfortable talking about it, can you give some examples? And I know you only know, right? You know your perspective and the way the world is to you, but maybe how you understand other people see you differently in some ways, perhaps.
Yeah. So, and I think that's a really key aspect of the conversation is to really bring home the fact that I do see the world differently. That was something that I did not realize until I was about 12 or 13 years old. Up to that point, obviously, you go through life and you have your perspective. Nothing really occurs to you that, people see things differently than you are, that there's different perspectives. It's when you realize that is kind of when the world becomes a different, point of view, altogether, because you realize, oh, people don't see things the way I do. For me, with autism, obviously, I see the world through a very sensory-based, a lens. In, some rooms are more difficult to be in than others. I have a very big sensitivity to light, so I'm very much, I don't like to have a lot of fluorescent lights in the room. I like incandescent, light in a room. And I'm really big on keeping the noise reduction down in areas that I'm at. So those are just some small things about how autism affects me. But when I talked about those things as a child, I really, you know, was met with a lot of, you know, confused looks, and people were always saying, you know, well, Taylor, no, the room isn't that bright, or it's not really that loud in here. And that always confused me, because I thought, I think it is, but obviously this person doesn't. And so it wasn't until, again, about 12 or 13 years old when I realized people do see things differently. And so I think that's a huge part of the conversation is with autism is talking about how it really does manifest, you know, in each person who is autistic and how we really present how autism, you know, affects us and the ways that, you know, we, you know, develop coping skills and the ability to live with it on a daily.
Mm. All right. Hannah Epker, let me bring you into the conversation now. Tell me a little bit about your family and autism.
Hi. Yes. So my secondborn son was diagnosed as being autistic around his second birthday. He is, again, my secondborn son, and he does have some higher support needs. He is minimally verbal, so he's not able to necessarily communicate how he's feeling or what could be distressing him, things that he is seeking, his wants, his desires. There's a lot of work we have to do to kind of get to that. We do utilize an AAC device, which has been amazing in really understanding that language is within him and he does have understanding. However, there is just what I believe to be the apraxia. There's this disconnect of his ability to utilize words to connect with us. And he also is an eloper, meaning he has the desire to run away without maybe having an understanding of safety concerns in his environment. So we have to be really on top of him. I always joke and say having my son has kind of made me become an athlete. Yeah, so that's where I'm at with him.
Yeah. You mentioned AAC. For people who aren't familiar, what does that look like? How does that work?
So an AAC device, it looks just like an iPad. And there are a number of different programs with different features that help you communicate. They have... kind of, I believe they call it multimodal communication, where there is a picture, there is the word of what that picture is, and then there is the sound. So they can select a button and then it is speaking for you, essentially. So at this point in time, we're kind of building together three word statements of I want food, go bye-bye car. Over time, we're hoping that this will grow and we'll be able to have more expansive language, but it is so personable and that I can customize it to have boards that are, let's say we're going to a new environment that he is unaware of or might have some anxieties about. I can create a board entirely about where we're going and what to expect and include pictures of it. So that way he has, again, an idea of what he's getting into and it's a little more familiar for him. So an AAC has been wonderful.
All right. And finally, I want to bring Zoe Gross into our conversation, Director of Advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. What are some of the misconceptions you have seen out there about autism?
There are loads. A big one, obviously very topical to our discussion today, is about the causation of autism, with some people mistakenly believing there's a link between vaccines and autism. This came from a fraudulent study published in the 90s in the UK that was retracted by the paper that published it. But there are still many people that believe this for some reason. And unfortunately, now we now have people in the highest levels of government promoting this idea. It really has been debunked by dozens of scientific studies all across the world, run by many different governments and universities. So the science is in on this one. We know there's no link between vaccines and autism, but unfortunately, some people still do put that forward.
Hannah, let's talk a little about our RFK Jr. And I should say we need to take a break in a few minutes, so I will have to interrupt after that. But how do you see parents in your network talking about the way Kennedy has talked about autism, and how is that affecting them?
I have seen both sides of the coin. I have seen other parents who are upset, who are wondering, do I need to protect my children's medical records and their data? I don't want this being shared with this man. And then I've seen others who yes, are maybe in harder circumstances, who aren't having their needs met, who are going, I am having such a hard time. And having an understanding of where this is coming from, why it is happening, I do seek that. So I do see, I see both sides. However, because of RFK Jr.'s history with vaccines and fear-mongering around vaccine schedules, I have a lot of hesitancy in trusting that he is actually getting to, quote-unquote, the bottom of autism.
All right, let me share a text message. We got a lot of response when we asked members of our group about this. And I should say, if you want to join our text messaging group, you can do that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. That's, again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Christopher in Brimfield said, in my humble opinion, cases of autism have been found because we look for them, and that's a good thing. I need real research that is based in science. We are talking about this today with Hannah Epker, who is a parent of an autistic child, advocate Taylor Sweeting, Zoe Gross of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and Molly Losh, professor of learning disabilities at Northwestern University. We are going to take a break on the program. If you want to join us, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. You can join us live on the air today, 800-222-9455. We want to know how autism affects people in your life. What do you think of RFK Jr.'s remarks and his approach to autism? And again, what do you think of this idea that he is going to try to find the cause of autism in a few months? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about how autism has become a focus of the nation's health agencies under the Trump administration, and specifically Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's declared autism as an epidemic. He has ordered research to find the cause of autism, though, as we'll get into, it isn't necessarily quite so simple. Another text message I want to share. Wendy in Shabana said, my oldest son was diagnosed when he was in his 30s as having Asperger's syndrome. He's highly intelligent, chemical engineer, went to an Ivy League university. Just because he has autism doesn't change anything about my feelings of pride for how well he's managed his life so far. My son has found ways to live a decent life and shouldn't be considered less than anyone else. As for finding the root cause, I think it's frivolous. It doesn't matter what caused it, as far as I'm concerned, in regard to my son. I'm going to love him no matter what. We're talking about this with Zoe Gross of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, parent Hannah Epker, autism advocate Taylor Sweeting, and Molly Losh, professor of learning disabilities at Northwestern University. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. All right, I want to get into more of what RFK Jr. has said about autism, and one of his perspectives has to do with how many kids are getting diagnosed. Let's listen to a little more of last month's news conference.
In 1987, out of 1 million, every 1 million kids, 330 were diagnosed with autism. Today, there are 27,777 for every million.
And we heard from, you know, he actually said autism is increasing at in prevalence at an alarming rate. We got some listener texts on this. Anna Nirvana said, I think his definition of autism shows vast ignorance. Any child with a disability challenges a family, but it doesn't destroy them. I also wonder if there has actually been a rise in autism, or in the past, many may have gone undiagnosed. And so Molly Losh, professor at Northwestern, to that question, is there a rise in autism, or is it that we are understanding it more, seeing it more, and maybe weren't diagnosing it as such in the past.
Right. Yeah. So this is an excellent question from the listener, and the CDC has been studying this question rigorously since 2000 across multiple sites throughout the United States. And yes, we've definitely seen a rise in the numbers, and this has been studied rigorously. The research data tell us that this increase is mainly due to changes in how autism is diagnosed. So, for instance, what would have been diagnosed as intellectual disability or a learning disability years ago is now diagnosed as autism. And then the second main factor is better recognition and screening among clinicians, educators, the general public. I know when I started in autism research in the late 90s, early 2000s, I would have to explain what autism was when I talked about what my aspiring career was. And even with, you know, my general practitioner, they didn't know what autism was. That never happens today. And so we have this swath of, you know, of aware and well-educated members of our community across clinical, educational, medical, and just, you know, just our general public context that are aware of autism. And so early detection and screening, there are more screening efforts now in place. All the research tells us that that is really the main source of these increases, that these numbers were always high and we just weren't measuring them correctly.
Zoe, how has this change in understanding that Molly was talking about, how has that played out in the way society sort of treats people with autism?
In interesting ways. So with increased recognition of autism, there have been more efforts to include some but not all autistic people in many ways, whether that's in school or in the workplace through autism-specific hiring efforts. But a lot of people say that some autistic people are getting left behind out of these, and they're correct. Many autism hiring efforts, for example, don't include autistic people who have intellectual disability or high support needs, but only include autistic people who, for example, want to be accountants or computer programmers. So there's a lot left to be done in terms of accommodating autistic people, making sure we and our families have the supports that we need, and fully including us in every aspect of society.
Taylor Sweeting, what do you make of this idea, as Kennedy said, that an increase in autism prevalence is quote unquote alarming?
Alarming in what way, I guess, is the question that I would present to him. What is alarming is that when I was younger, when first diagnosed in the early 90s, autism, again, it was still this new and upcoming thing. People, you know, hadn't really, you know, heard of it, and it was still kind of coming out of the woodwork. And for me, it was such an isolating experience. This idea that I was diagnosed with something that, you know, was... it seemed astronomically, you know, rare. And so for me, I was always made to feel like you're the only one who has autism. And as isolating and alone as some autistic people can feel just, you know, living with their autism, couple that with the fact that I had no real support other than this idea that I had this diagnosis, we're just kind of, you know, experimenting and seeing what works and what doesn't. So that is what I have found to be the alarming factor to this. Having an awareness and ultimately an understanding of, you know, why autism, you know, is so important to identify at an early age, to see, you know, that these numbers, what arguably I would say, you know, these numbers have been, you know, pretty solid since the beginning. We're just now recognizing them. I think, you know, it's exactly the opposite of alarming, that we're coming up with this sense of awareness and ultimately the sense of acceptance. Again, I grew up in a time when autism was not very well accepted. And the world that I'm seeing today and the world that I am advocating in today is a completely different world than what I started out with.
Hannah, what difference has a diagnosis made for your family?
Oh my gosh, it was an opening, a pathway to gaining assistance, to gaining accommodations. It is what got us into therapies, and bless these therapists who are working side by side with us to help us better understand and navigate my child's care. A diagnosis was so important, and getting to know my child better and the intricacies of who he is as a person is so important to me. So very important.
All right. I want to listen to one more clip from the news conference of RFK Jr. Let's hear that.
These are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date.
Zoe, what goes through your mind when you hear those remarks?
Two things. The first thing is that they're not true. Plenty of autistic people do those things. Most of us don't do all of those things at once, but most people don't do all of those things at once, whether or not they're autistic. At any rate, he's wrong about this. But the second thing I think is that there are some people who don't do any of those things, autistic people or people with other disabilities. And they can still live great, fulfilling lives, be contributing members to their communities. And they deserve better than to be used as a rhetorical device to make people scared of autism. It doesn't need to scare people like this, and it doesn't help people who can't do those things. If not being able to do those things is being presented as something that's so bad and terrifying.
Molly, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I just want to underscore Zoe's comments. These are harmful, inflammatory comments that lead me to believe that Secretary Kennedy does not have a lot of experience with the autism community. And I'm also disturbed in conversations and, you know, monitoring social media, the scientific and advocacy communities have been equally concerned about how these sorts of comments harken back to a time where individuals with autism, other neurodevelopmental conditions, were viewed as a burden, and that's very disturbing.
Is part of what's happening here? And Molly, I'll ask you. You know, on the one hand, we've been talking about people who, you know, live, full lives, they have jobs, they go on dates and write poetry and pay taxes, though maybe not all at the same time, as Zoe said. You know, and then there are people who do have significant needs. They're not verbally communicative. And, you know, maybe there is, you know, something to be done there in terms of trying to figure out and better understand that. How do you think about, is it a category confusion on his part or our part, or how are you thinking about that?
I mean, that's a really complex question. I think, you know, on the sociopolitical front, individuals who have high support needs in the autism community are, you know, their personhood is just as real as anyone else's. They're loved and valued by their family members, and those comments are just very offensive. On the research front, we are actively working to understand what are the factors, the neurobiological factors, genetic factors that are at play in determining someone's level of support needs, whether, you know, they're able to develop functional language abilities. This is an active area of research that is desperately in need of more funding, federal funding. And I would say I'm concerned that is in jeopardy under this current administration.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-222-9455. Reverend Ken is on the line from Rockford. Thank you for waiting patiently. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you very much. I think the subject matter, anytime talking about this, is healthy and good. But I have a question. Why do we give credence to Kennedy? The man is not credentialed. And why does the media give him such a pass. I mean, even having these conversations, and it's important to have a conversation about autism, but even this conversation gives credence to what he's saying, that the man is a liar. And we ought to say that straightforward so that he doesn't hurt people anymore. And besides that, he's not going to give any funds toward helping this. So I think we got to quit giving people like this a pass and just call them out right away as not telling the truth.
Thank you so much for the call, Ken. I really appreciate that. Zoe, do you want to respond to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. We've heard many things from Secretary Kennedy about autism that just aren't true, and especially focusing on vaccines. He said many things that aren't true. He said vaccines aren't safety tested. That's not true. He said that they're not compared to other products or placebo tested in their original development. That's not true. And he, the way he talks about autism is designed to stop people from using their thinking brains when they're thinking about autism and have people reacting in fear instead. That's a really concerning way for the leader of our nation's public health to be talking about people with disabilities. We want to be avoiding that. We want people to be thinking logically and reacting empathetically and moving towards full inclusion of disabled people in society.
Yeah, and I'll also say, you know, the caller mentioned he doesn't have sort of credentials or and why are we giving him credence? I'll say he has a lot of power and he is affecting policy right now in the United States in significant ways. And that's why I certainly think it's worth talking about this stuff. Hannah, I don't think I've had a chance to ask you about your as a parent of an autistic child, your response to particularly those remarks where Kennedy, I think, is trying to be empathetic, right? When he says, not going to go on a date, that sort of thing. How do you hear that?
Zoe had kind of mentioned earlier about how it's both true and not true, in that there are individuals who are not going to be able to utilize the bathroom on their own, and that is okay. Anyone neurotypical or neurodivergent can become disabled at any time and not be able to use a bathroom. They still have inherent value as a human being and should be treated as such. So when I hear those remarks, what I hear is him saying essentially, this individual isn't going to be a taxpayer. They're not going to be contributing financially into society. And I think that that's so silly. That is not reflective of our value as people. So that is how I feel about that. And truly, if something that I keep coming back to is if he has such care, he's acting as though he has care about the autistic community and wanting to eliminate all of these issues, I don't think we should be studying the root cause of autism. I think we should be having further research on apraxias, on seizure disorders, GI issues, restrictive eating disorders, all these comorbidities that come with an autism diagnosis, so that once we get to the bottom of that and can have better accommodation, that they can have more fulfilling day-to-day lives.
Molly, do you want to take on specifically that aspect of it and some of the cuts that we've seen elsewhere under Kennedy and the Trump administration? I should say we need to take a break in less than a minute, so it'll have to be brief.
I'll be quick. Yeah, no, Hannah is so right. There's research in all these important areas so needed, and there's research underway, but really disturbing is evidence that, so Reuters last week published a really terrific article that investigated recent cuts to autism research and the impact of those cuts. They found that about 25% or more than 25% of autism research had been reduced, or 25% reduction in autism research funding. Now, some of this is due to President Trump's executive orders to purge research involving any focus on DEI or gender ideology. Some is part of targeted actions to specific universities, and then some is just we don't know. There are lots of active grants that haven't been renewed. Even without notice of termination, the funds just haven't been made available to continue that research, and there's no explanation.
So, all right. Well, we have to take a break. Sorry to interrupt. We will continue this conversation when we return. This is the 21st show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about how autism has become a focus of the nation's health agencies under the Trump administration. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has declared autism an epidemic, and he has ordered research to find the cause of autism, though, as we'll get into, that isn't quite so simple. We're also just talking about the way we understand autism in our society. We heard from a number of people sort of raising this point. John in Rockford, for example, asks if an overly broad definition of autism has become another weapon in what he sees as an assault on neurological diversity. He says there is no one right way of thinking, learning, and behaving, and differences cannot be viewed as deficits. That people experience and interact with the world around them in many different ways is a good thing. Indeed, it's a valuable part of our human evolutionary legacy. We also heard from Betsy in Rockford, who said Kennedy's already decided the cause is environmental, and that's not how we find answers. He has no evidence, and numerous studies have debunked that. Betsy also says, I am recently diagnosed at age 54. We need better understanding and acceptance. My brain works differently, and so many things about modern life are extremely difficult for me to deal with without support. Luckily, I have some. Again, if you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. We're talking about this with Zoe Gross of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, parent Hannah Epker, autism advocate Taylor Sweeting, and Molly Losh, professor of learning disabilities at Northwestern University. Zoe, let me ask you to respond to some of those text messages we heard, particularly the one on this idea of what the person said was an assault on neurological diversity.
Yeah, it was a really interesting message. I definitely agree that what people like Secretary Kennedy are doing when they try to make people afraid of autism is responding negatively to the existing neurological diversity that is just part of human existence. But I don't think that we have an overly broad definition of autism. I think the definition of autism has broadened over the years when we've realized clinically that distinctions that we used to draw, such as the distinction between autism and Asperger syndrome, weren't being reliably made, and people really couldn't tell where the line was, where one condition ended and the other began. And that's why we made those two diagnoses into one diagnosis of autism. So I don't think it's that the definition of autism is now too broad. I think it is more accurately encompassing a larger range of types of brain types of behavior.
Maybe we should listen to one last clip from RFK Jr. Now, this is something he said at a cabinet meeting last month.
By September, we will know what has caused the autism epidemic, and we'll be able to eliminate those exposures.
Okay, Molly, one of our other texters got at this idea of, you know, exposures and environmental toxins, I think is a phrase that he used. What do we know about this?
Yeah, I mean, this was inflammatory language, and boy, I will say there are hundreds of incredibly dedicated people who have been working on the question of the causes of autism and whether and what the environmental influences might be for over 30 years. And if there were something easy to find, we would have, I can definitively say, we would have found it. And, you know, I think he went on to suggest that it was mold or food additives or ultrasounds. And the comment, his language just suggests that he's not collaborating with scientists who are at the top of the field. And it's a bit baffling. We do know there are some environmental causes, not food additives or ultrasounds, but really what has emerged from, again, this, you know, decades of rigorous research are factors like parental age, particularly the age of fathers, older fathers, it's more likely to have a child with autism in those family units, Lower birth weight, for instance, is another example. But even these are thought to be environmental factors that are interacting with background genetics, where we have, you know, over 200 identified high confidence genes that are related to autism and interacting with each other and interacting with environmental factors. So that really is where the science is pointing us, not towards some sort of silver bullet environmental factor that, you know, 30 years of research hasn't found.
Taylor, I want to come back to you. One more text message from Randy in rural Peoria County, who says, the spectrum has been out of hand, but the answer is not fluoride or ghost stories. The answer is better training and understanding. Another one of the many things where I'm in agreement of the idea and in horror of the backwoods, uninformed, and dangerous ways to solve it. Taylor, what do you make of this idea that Randy mentioned, that maybe there is something that can or should be done, but, you know, just not this?
I mean, anytime autism is brought up to the table for conversation, I have to, you know, accept it for what it is, that, you know, we're talking about it and we're bringing obviously awareness to it. But I agree that when you're bringing it up in this way, that you're creating this fear propaganda around it, that this is something that, you know, it's an epidemic, and, you know, we have to, you know, get to the bottom of this so that we can divert, you know, these diagnoses. That is where the rhetoric turns and where this idea of the conversation is going in the wrong direction. Because, again, I'm not something that needs to be cured. I have embraced my autism for what it is and what it has made me. And for me to hear one of my leaders, maybe not necessarily, you know, a leader that I chose, but regardless, a leader that has come and said that I'm destroying my family, that I'm not contributing to society, that I'm not, you know, being this productive member of society. It's very painful. It's very hurtful. And it's one of those conversations where it's like we're going away from this idea that people have inherent human value, which is ultimately where I believe my awareness continues to go into the direction of, but also where I think we're missing the mark is everyone, autistic people included, have inherent human value. And when we stop looking at what contributions we're giving to society, whether that's big or small, indifferent, whatever, is irregardless. It's still contributing to society. And I think that's where we need to start shifting our focus, is that inherent human value and trying to enrich the lives of autistic people and to provide them with the accommodations and the acceptance that they so desperately need. And if I could be frank, that we so desperately deserve.
Zoe, you're based in Washington. Have you heard the administration in any way responsive to any of the concerns that have been raised, especially by your organization?
No, in fact, we've had very limited contact with the whole Federal Agency of Health and Human Services since the beginning of this administration, which is very unusual for us and for the autistic community generally. In previous administrations of both parties, ASAN and other autism organizations have had contact with workers within Health and Human Services, have been able to raise concerns, have been asked to discuss projects, but in terms of this new autism, quote-unquote, study that's being launched by HHS, none of us have been consulted, not ASAN and not other autism organizations. So it is, I would say that the administration has been very limited in their response to the concerns of the autistic community.
Hannah, let me ask you, what sort of research would you like to see about autism? And maybe the sort of broader question is, if you could, you know, if there was going to be a government official who was going to put his or her shoulder into this, you know, into this area, how would you like to see them directing their energy?
I would hope for them to direct their energy into improving the quality of life of autistic individuals. I had mentioned earlier, there is a high association of all these comorbidities, that being apraxias, seizure disorders, GI issues, ARFID, that being a restrictive eating disorder. If we had more research on these comorbidities so that these individuals can have more ease of navigating day-to-day life, I believe they would have even a more improved quality of life. I have a very hard time trusting that RFK Jr. is truly putting his research where it needs to be. I believe it's been $2.7 billion has been eliminated in research grants through the National Institute of Health in the last 2 to 3 months. And we have fear of the Department of Education being dismantled and IDEA funding being responsible from the HHS. So it's very scary. And I think that we all need to continue to be raising our voices and putting our foot down about this.
Zoe, what as an advocate, what advice would you have for people at this time? You know, this is something we hear a lot. People are frustrated. What can they do?
So one thing people can do is go to our website, autisticadvocacy.org, and check out our action alerts. And there you will find ways to get involved and help promote policies that will benefit autistic people and other people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And one of the biggest things that we're working on right now is trying to stop Congress from implementing massive cuts to Medicaid. Medicaid, especially the home and community-based services waivers, is a program that many autistic people across the country rely on to live in our communities and avoid being forced to move to institutions. It's a really lifeline program for many people. Hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts are being proposed in Congress right now. We're trying to stop it. And I would encourage anyone who wants to be an ally to autistic people and others with disabilities to get involved.
Molly, I'm gathering you're not going to want to speak for Northwestern as an institution, but as somebody who is a professor and researcher there, I'm sure you are well aware that, you know, it is one of the higher ed institutions that has been in conflict with the Trump administration, or rather the Trump administration has been in conflict with, I guess is how to frame that. But what can people do from your perspective?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yes, I'm well aware. I was a part of a really wonderful meeting with directors at different institutes, at the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation, just on this topic of the cuts across some of these targeted universities. And their advice was call your congressional representatives and call them daily. To express your concerns about the defunding of autism research in particular. Join advocacy groups, go out and protest, make your voice heard. I'm concerned about not only the pause in research that is going to, or has the potential to impact the lives of autistic persons and their families, but also the next generation of clinicians and researchers who would be entering the field. This is, you know, they're discouraged. I've seen people leaving the field. This is a really critical time.
All right. I want to thank my guests on the program today, Molly, Taylor, Zoe, and Hannah. Thank you all so much for being with us today and talking about this important subject on the 21st show.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Molly, very much.
Molly Losh is a professor of learning disabilities and associate dean for research at Northwestern University School of Communications. Taylor Sweeting is an autism self-advocate, disability self-advocate based here in Springfield, Illinois. Zoe Gross, director of advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. And Hannah Epker, parent of an autistic child in the Chicagoland area. Thank you to everyone who called in and especially sent text messages in to participate in our program today. If you would like to be among them in the future, you can join our text messaging group by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or stories. You can get in touch with us by emailing talk at 21stshow.org, and you can find that address and every other way to connect with us on our website, 21stshow.org. We've got our past programs there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also now find us on YouTube by searching for the Illinois Public Media page. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.